Education Committee will be called to order. Today is Monday, March 19, 2012. Time is 8:05. Present are Representative Foggy, Representative Seaton, Representative Peggy Wilson, Representative Pruitt, and myself, Representative Alan Dick. Cell phones off. A little different sequence today because of activity upstairs. Representative Pruitt and I will have to leave at just a hair before 9 o'clock. So, and at that time, Dr. Norm Eck will give his presentation, a movie, and Representative Pruitt and I will watch the recording of that. We'll get caught up later. Okay, so our first order of business today is a continuation of our discussion regarding the proposed state education standards. In response to committee members' requests, you again have testimony from educators and superintendents about the concerns regarding adopted proposed standards. I believe we have copies of that. So, Commissioner Hanley, if you wouldn't please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and The intent here is just to have really good, meaningful dialogue, good questions. Commissioner, you have total freedom to share whatever thoughts you might have on your mind, responses to my responses, to your responses, or however you might want to orchestrate that. The intent is that we are all well-informed and we've had a good, meaningful dialogue. Okay. So, Commissioner Hanley, do you want to say something first, or how would you like that to go, sir?
Chair Dick, for the record, my name is Mike Hanley, Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development, and I'm sure be willing to follow your lead. I've got some things I can share, or I can surely answer questions as you see fit.
Why don't you go ahead and share your thoughts, and we'll try to respond to them.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to begin just with a couple of clarifications. On my thoughts in regards to not in regards to HB 330, but in regards to the letter, I believe that Representative sent reasons for not adopting proposed Alaska state standards.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I'd like to begin with just a couple of things that I do think need some clarification. Several times in the letter, it was mentioned that a full third of our ninth graders will leave before graduating. In actuality, the dropout rate for 2011 was 4.7%. If we look at that's an annual rate. So if we looked at a cohort, you go from ninth grade to 12th grade, we'd be looking at it closer to an 18 or 19% as opposed to a third. That's still too high, but I did want to make that clarification.
Excuse me, Commissioner, help me understand, mm-hmm. because and I'm really thankful for that clarification. So you're saying then of all of our current ninth graders, mm-hmm. or of the ninth graders 4 years ago, 18% of them did not complete high school. Is that correct?
We're considered dropouts.
We're considered dropouts. Okay. And that is to say then that the other 82% got a high school diploma.
They went on. They could have been fifth-year graduates. They could have been, sixth-year graduates. We have a small percent of students who are not considered dropouts, but who have severe cognitive disabilities. And so there's 2-3% there that don't graduate, but aren't considered dropouts. They're moved into, life skills trainings and things like that, wow. as per their IEPs.
Thank you for clarifying, Representative Cisna.
Thank you. I don't know that this is really the time, but at the same time, speaking of dropouts, and you mentioned cognitively disabled, or that would actually also fit the fetal alcohol effect kinds of students as well. And those, as I recall, we were doing a big focus on that for some time, and now have pulled back on, at least that's what I've seen, on identifying people in that category, and they would also fit that category. Isn't that right?
Through the Chair, Representative Cisna, when I spoke about the 2% of severely cognitive disabilities, I was really referring to students who really focused, and I had several classrooms of these in both schools that I worked in. Students who are learning to communicate with devices, who are learning to feed themselves, who are learning to clothe themselves, those types of things. Now, fetal alcohol syndrome is a whole spectrum, as you recognize, and there could be students that don't graduate there. There are definitely some challenges with that that disability, but those weren't the ones I was referring to in the 2%.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Continuing down through the paper, Representative Dick, there's a concern about the language that is used in the standards, whether it's these new proposed standards or in our current standards or in most standards that you see, recognizing that excuse me, the audience is educators and implementers of the standards, and it is very important for those implementers, those educators, to have enough specificity in the standards so that they are all teaching towards the same criteria. Generalities don't work in standards because we could end up trying to measure one thing and teaching several different directions. So there is a level of specificity in the standards to help give that that focus for educators. One of the items mentioned here was the Elite 7. And I know you've seen the chart. I don't have it with me. It was the bar chart of how many kids start in high school and then how many 7% actually go on to graduate college in 6 years. And that's a dismal percentage, and I won't argue that. And I don't think we can take full responsibility, but I think the K-12 system definitely needs to take some responsibility for those statistics. But I would say that our standards are not aimed necessarily for those 7%. If they were, we would definitely be considered failing, because only 7% of our kids are actualizing what we're trying to teach. And the fact, though, when you look at that chart, a good portion of them move on to careers, and just a much higher percentage move on to the careers and into jobs. And so I think that we truly have college and career-ready standards. If anything, we need to strengthen the college portion. We need to get them ready, because we do recognize, and we've heard from the university system, that for every remediation course kids need when they walk into the university system, their chances of graduating declines. So we need to get rid of that need for remediation, so we definitely need to strengthen that area.
Commissioner, can I yes. comment really quickly? And one thing we need to identify with our University of Alaska system is that, you know, with Harvard and other places, they have, you know, admissions requirements. Here, anybody can walk off the street into our university system. So we really shouldn't, we need to take that into consideration, because, you know, we'll accept anybody. And so if there is a large number of students that need remediation, we need to keep that in proportion. We shouldn't hold it against our university and even necessarily our high schools, because we do have open admission. And Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I agree with you that we have to be careful of the comparison. However, when we look at the kids that are getting the top 10% of their class to go to the university, and I forget whether it's 35 or 50% of those have to take remediation courses, and those are those that are, you know, given that, I mean, I don't think our job is well enough preparing the kids to go to college for college. And so I just want to make sure that we're not saying it's the other, that those that are going to college are prepared. Because we have the top 10% of our graduating class from each school across our state are having to, a significant portion are having to take remediation courses. So I just want to make sure we clarify that. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you. And President Gamble would recognize that as well. We don't have a community college system. We could probably compare it side by side with, you know, a community college system elsewhere, but the real point is we need our kids to be prepared for whatever post-secondary education they take. I'd like to consider just briefly some of the testimony that we heard from superintendents to date. And I know that education overall has been, to some, deemed the broken paradigm. And there's no way I would say that, you know, we're doing perfect. You know, we don't need to improve, because we have a long ways to go. But I was encouraged by the number of testimonies that you heard, and I was taking notes as I was listening in on those, and I know you heard them as well. But you know, we heard Eric Gephardt from Nenana talk about the VOCAD that they do, the dual credits with Western Oregon, student leadership teams, Phil Knight from Aleutians East, the laptops. They've got 100% graduation. They use Acklin distance delivery. Valdez has a graduation rate in the 90s. Tlaloc, they teach work ethic, and their mission is exemplary, well-rounded education for the whole child, with a 91% graduation rate, low teacher turnover, and a focus on youth employability skills. Delta Greeley, welding, construction, trades, forensics, robotics. Most kids participate in some extracurricular activity with a graduation rate of 79%. There's a lot of positives taking place, and I think that I would struggle to look them in the eye and say, no, you're a broken paradigm. I don't think we have school districts across the board. I don't think we can use that generality to say that there is this flaw across the board. Yes, we need to improve, but I think we've got a lot of shining lights in here, including three districts that have now said that the state standards are not enough, that we need to raise our standards, and they've gone ahead and done that. Gateway School District with Todd Pogue, they focus on the Common Core, which you might have heard reference to. It's a set of standards that 49 states have adopted, developed by the National Governors Association. Juneau School District also has decided, you know, we've got to bump up. We've got to move towards something higher. They also teach the Common Core. And Anchorage just last week made the announcement that they'll be taking to the school board their recommendation to raise the bar. They've said the state standards are not enough. We need to offer our kids more, and that they will be adopting the Common Core. So, you know, there are states that are districts that are saying, we don't think that it's broken, but we need more. We need to offer our kids more. The new proposed standards that we have reference heavily the Common Core. There are more similarities with the state standards and the Common Core than there are differences. But we did recognize, and one thing as we developed those, and since I've been here, I wanted to make sure that if 45 states, if our country for the most part is aiming at a particular level of rigor, that Alaska needs to match that level of rigor. It would be totally inappropriate for us. Our standards can be different, but we have to be up at that level because those are the people that our kids are competing with. We'd be doing them a disservice to have anything less. So those are some things that are taking place right now that that I do think. One reference where our standards currently are and also where our proposed standards are. And I can keep going, but I know that there's a couple questions.
Yes, and also I need to recognize that Representative Kawasaki, Wilson, and Sisson have joined us too. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you mentioned some schools that are really doing a good job. Do you have a list? Obviously, if we've got some schools in the state that are outstanding, they're doing a good job, I assume that you guys have looked at them, tried to figure out what they're doing right, so that you can share it with the other schools to help them out. Do you have a list, or are there what are the things that they're doing that, you know, besides what you just mentioned, that we can pass on? And I assume that you've taken it and showed other schools in the state what's going on so that they can try to grow and do as well.
Right. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Wilson. It's all subjective on how you measure it, successful schools. But I think we could recognize some that have high performance, have a lot of programs in place. What I will say is that I don't believe a program makes the difference. You could take a program and put it in two different places, and it's successful in one, it's not successful in another. I don't think we can quantify it and make it quite that concrete. It really becomes the attitude and the vision and the focus of the people that take that tool and decide what they do with it. I just spoke to UConn, Carrie Boyd in the UConn Koyukuk, and I don't believe she spoke this. Maybe she has spoken this year. I don't remember if she's testified this year. But she's one of the districts that just came out of intervention. And they used a program that they just bought into. And when I went up there and visited with them, their teachers were all chanting, "Our kids are worth whatever it takes." And they said that throughout. And that's kind of a core foundation of this. And they used that as a foundation, and they jumped off with it, and they did great things. And they're continuing to do great things. They're looking to spread that out to other districts. But they also recognize that you can have a curriculum that says, "Our kids are worth whatever it takes." But if you don't embody that, it's just a curriculum that says, "Our kids are worth whatever it takes." So it's not easily quantifiable, but we surely can share those things. I think you've heard a lot of them. I mean, these came from the testimony to you, but we try to interact with districts with those things.
Then if it's not the program and it's the attitude of the teachers, then are we trying to do teacher development in ways that we can excite teachers to get them excited? I mean, are we following through and seeing what's working and helping the rest of them? Because I think there's a lot of schools that need intervention that aren't on the list, you know, because we just need to do a better job across the state, and I'm just wondering what you guys have done.
Great. Through Chair Representative Wilson, we're doing exactly that. We're looking at our state system of support, which are our coaches that are in our intervention district, and trying to maximize their use. So rather than having coaches go out with each expertise, and so maybe having two or three coaches out in the district at a time to train each coach so we can send one out at a time and spread the wealth a little bit to more schools and more districts. But that's exactly what the vision of those coaches are, to really empower the teachers and build the capacity there.
Okay, and if I could just suggest here now, too, because if we get off on education, we're going to take forever.
Okay.
The whole issue of standards refers, there's two basic focuses, focuses within education. One is what is taught, and the other is how it's taught. If we get into how it's taught, we could be here, the committee process isn't long enough.
Good point.
So right now we're talking about standards, and standards are the what of what of our educational system. Representative Sisson.
Regarding the what, I can't get away from the fact we are talking different departments here, and because we have to. You can't just take one thing and study that, because it's all tied together. And what I've been told over and over is that the Native Alaskans, the first Alaskans, stayed in communities because they knew they needed to for their kids, for the schools. But now communities are shrinking and not being able to even keep the school open because the populations, as we last Friday or whatever it was, we were talking to a school that was doing extraordinarily well, but they lost half of their Skagway lost half of their population in 10 years, I think it was. And that's happening all over in rural Alaska. And obviously, yeah, there's some real wonderful shining lights, not a doubt about it. And I think in the urban schools, probably the same is true, that there's some schools that are really great, some are not. One is University Link. Need to have schools that teach the teachers. They need to come with the inner, kind of an inner core feeling, like the kids are worth whatever it takes. I'd love that to be the big standard. I mean, that really is it, because if teachers come in trained with that they may not always understand what's going on in the community, and that's rural or urban. But nonetheless, it's everything that they can do, no matter what. Those kids are really super special. I'm wondering on these standards. I keep wondering about this, and that issue of what the standards really are and what role they really play, to me, doesn't feel developed in the way that I feel comfortable with. So I hope that we have more conversations about this. And is this committee really the only place that we could have these discussions? Is it ever possible to maybe have an hour or two to just sit down with you and work out all of these things and have whatever committee member wants to come really work through it?
Representative Sisson, the answer to that is, of course. Perhaps you and the commissioner and I or anybody else could have a work session on that. Okay. Representative Seaton, did you have a question?
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. I guess the basic premise that we're talking about is the state standards, and we have language and we have math. And I have, I'm still trying to get a handle, and I'd like you to present to us the structure of the existing standards and then the structure of the new standards. I mean, last time when the deputy commissioner was here, we talked about the standards of mathematical practice, which I don't see that same similar parallel in the English language arts standards. And I'm not sure when we're talking about standards, whether we're talking about standards of mathematical practice, whether we're talking about the content standards, and then we have the grade level, used to be grade level expectations, now there's something else. Can you go over for us and give us the broad general gestalt of how the existing standards are there, how the new standards are constructed, and how they are conceptually different, not the individual standard per what a math standard is, but conceptually how that all works so that we can understand, or at least I can understand, the difference in the standards and what they mean. And then also how that change in standards and the application of this new system is going to affect school districts. But first of all, the basic understanding of standards.
All right. Thank you. It's a big question. There's not a whole huge paradigm shift in the standards. There aren't a whole lot of new standards under the sun. There's some adjustments of where those standards are and some specificity in how the standards are written. In simplicity, if you were to look at our standards now, they are specific enough where we don't need a whole separate level of GLEs, grade level expectations. A teacher in any grade level could look at the standards and say, I understand what my kids need to learn by the time they've left my grade level.
And just for clarification, you're talking about the current standards that we're operating under now?
No, the proposed standards will not need a whole separate set of GLEs. They are specific enough where a teacher can look at those and have what she needs, he or she needs, and understand fully what the child needs when they graduate from that grade level.
Okay, and how is that different? I want the current standards we're operating under, and then the change from the current standards that we're operating under to this new standards of mathematical practice, and then the different grade level, and what are we talking about when you come to us and tell us the new standards? Which of those, or what kind of structure are we commenting on?
Previously, we had, when the standards were developed, we had a set of, they were content standards. Here's basically the content a student needs to know. From there, it was said, well, how do we measure that? Well, we need to break that down into a set of performance standards, something that we can measure that shows that they've grasped this content. Those performance standards became the GLEs, the grade level expectations, something that teachers could use to measure. So they really had a way to quantify if the students were learning it or not. So it went from content to performance and GLEs. What's written now is more of a performance-based, and teachers can look at that. And some say they're too specific, but I believe that they're concrete and specific enough so the teacher says, I can see this, and I can measure this and understand if a child knows this skill or not. So we haven't had to break it down from content down to performance. We've really set it up with a general overlying strand, and then the standards become the performance measures. Now, as the biggest change, this is an oversimplification, but the biggest change is things have shifted among grade levels. We didn't suddenly write a whole new set of standards, and things that were never in there are now in there, but what we've done is we've shifted them. And, you know, what might have been learned in fifth grade now might be learned in fourth grade. To increase some rigor. Again, that's an oversimplification, but there's been a shifting of standards and some clarification of standards in these new ones. And it allows us to go a little bit farther before we just went up to 10th. It allows us to extend what now our kids are expected to know by the time they get out of high school. I don't know. That gets where you need to go.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on that, then, where are these new standards of mathematics practice? Where do they fall in this list of, I mean, we have, my understanding is we have content standards, we have standards of mathematical practice, and then we have the individual classroom grades. And so I'm hearing you talking about our new things, or talking about classroom performance standards, basically. Right. But I'm not sure where these other two, the content levels and the standards of mathematical practice, fall into the system that you're talking about.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I wasn't prepared to speak to the math. I didn't bring the math. I brought the language arts standards with me.
The language arts standards don't have any standards of language arts practice in them like the mathematical right. standards do. And that's one thing that's confusing to us, is right. we have two sets of standards on two basic things, and they seem to be organized in totally different systems. One has these practical.
Right. And they do reflect the two different skill sets. Math is a very concrete, you know, adding, subtract, single-digit numbers. When you look at reading at a certain grade level, what does reading mean? Well, there's several components to reading. There's vocabulary and phonics and phonemic awareness and understanding. So there's all of those things. So that they do look very different to represent the content area. I'd be glad to sit down. Like I said, I don't have the math with me, but I'd be glad to bring next time. I know we're up for Wednesday as well, to have those two side by side, and we can walk through those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sisson, in one second, let me, if I could comment. I try to do my homework here, and we're all trying to understand. But I did go to the higher-level math teacher here in Juneau, and I asked her. She has a master's degree in mathematics, and she teaches all the higher-level math. And so I asked her, I said, are these Alaska standards of mathematical practice? Do you do these? And she said, yes, as much as I can. These are good teaching practices, you know. And I said, do you view these as telling you how to teach? You know, are we, because standards tell what is going to be taught. It's up to the districts to really determine how they will teach. And I said, are these standards for mathematical practice, are they really telling you how to teach? Are they, you know, kind of reaching into your domain? And there was a long pause. And her answer was, if I can remember correctly, yes, but they're good. So she didn't feel threatened by those. And my question of her was, do you see, okay, you're a mathematics teacher. Now, can you see somebody, maybe the one or two high school, there's two high school teachers in a school. Your focus is mathematics. And so you live and breathe this. And I said, but how about a teacher maybe in Delta or one of the smaller communities? Would they be able to do this? And again, there was a long pause. And I said, where would you as a teacher learn how to do this? Did you learn to do this do you learn it in college? You know, where did you learn these good practices? And there was a long pause again. And I think the NCTM website is a good place to go. So there is a resource for teachers to go there. But I'm just saying that I'm not sure that every teacher in Alaska is able to incorporate all of these as good as they are. And then my other question was, if a teacher were to do these or were not to do these, how would you ever evaluate whether the teacher was doing these things? And again, there was a long pause. And the answer is, there's no way to measure a student whether they're actually have been taught in this fashion. It's really hard to, what you would have to have is actually classroom evaluation, somebody standing in the classroom saying, that's happening here and that's happening there. So, okay, so I said that for the sake of clarification. I believe these are really, really important. It's good stuff. But one, I'm not sure all our teachers are prepared to do this. I'm not sure we have the resources for us to professionally develop to make sure they all do this. I think it'd be extremely hard in a small high school. And at the same time, whether we could ever assess whether a student had been taught this way or not, I think it'd be very difficult. Representative Sisman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I got most of my school experience and time in. Self-esteem was the big concern. We were really worried about self-esteem. We seem not to worry about that anymore. And we especially don't worry about it because we're building for, but this is the way I'm seeing this, is that our goal here is college ready. It's getting kids college ready. And college meaning that it's anything that is beyond high school, that is skill sets beyond high school. Would that be kind of close? Skill sets that work in urban settings, not skill sets that work outside of urban centers. And cultural sensitivity appears to me to be kind of missing. And if, in fact, what you're doing is you're getting them college ready, that's what we're testing for. We're testing for that. We're not testing for people being able to work with each other. There's no good tests for that, are there? We're testing for things that actually aren't the thing that keep most people employed. Because if you can't work with people, you don't stay. Those are the people that go. And we're not testing for those things that the kids with fetal alcohol problems, with other cognitive problems, still would be good for. It still could be, and sometimes are, amazingly skilled. We don't test for that because there's no real test. There's something really missing here to me. We do have different kinds of people, different kinds of places in this state, and I think they all deserve a good education. But I think somehow we're leaving huge, big packets of people behind. And I think this state ought to challenge that, personally. And I think we thinking about education need to challenge that, too. We want every one of those kids to excel at what they're good for and what they want. How do you work that into this discussion?
Thank you, Representative Sisna. You're right, those are skills that are critical but are very difficult to assess. And I don't know if we want to assess those on a statewide level. I do think when we see districts saying we focus on employability skills, we focus on citizenship, we focus on that's the key for districts to really build up those characteristics that they believe are very important, that I believe are very important. But to set that standard at the state level and say this is what it should look like, I don't know. I think the characteristics might look slightly different from community to community. But we would recognize the fact that every one of them needs to be able to work well with others, be able to problem solve, be good citizens, et cetera. I do think you pointed out a very good thing, though, important comment you made in regards to shrinking communities. And we're seeing that happening across the state, especially in rural Alaska. They're shrinking. I don't believe that we can have a set of standards that focuses on rural Alaska because those areas are shrinking, not because of standards, not because of education, but they are shrinking. I think we need to provide students with the opportunity to be successful anywhere they choose to go, including rural Alaska. And so that's a difference between setting a standard that provides opportunities for them there and setting a set of standards that provides opportunities for them there and elsewhere. Because what we see now, we see an average adult change his career 5 times. We need to be able to to educate them with a basic set of skills that allows them those opportunities to change careers five times if that's what they choose, whether it's in their communities or out of their communities.
This is true. Just one follow-up. What's really missing here is that we're not really studying. We haven't taken on the study of what's happening in rural Alaska the way we need to. And as long as we don't, we're batting in the dark. And we're getting continual results of numbers of kids that are dropping out of school, numbers of homeless children in urban settings, number of homeless people in urban settings, the decline of a whole big bunch of things that you can test. Mm-hmm. And we as a state have to start changing our priorities and what we're doing. And I'm going to just be a voice just screaming at that one.
And that's good. I don't know if that's an educational issue to determine how why communities are shrinking.
It fits.
Yeah, so I don't know what organization would determine that dynamic.
And we're really open to further questions here. My question, Commissioner, is, and I'm just trying to gently focus here. I have the email from Diane Behrens, who has said, data was published fall of 2010 reflects that 7 out of 100 Alaskan ninth graders will complete a college credential on time. And so the whole issue, maybe the ultimate question we all have to ask and all have to answer is, are our standards, and we want rigor, but rigor could be in many different directions. We could have rigor in terms of heading people to careers. We could have tremendous rigor in that direction. Nobody's arguing with the need for rigor. The question is, what is going to be the focus of our rigor? Rigor is not the question. So the question is, is our curriculum or our standards, are they directed for that 7% that are going to actually finish a four-year degree? Or are our standards going to be directed at all students, and will we have a fast track for those who really do need to head up to that? And we all hope to go to that 7%. There's no mistake there. And so I'd just like to point to a couple, and I realize that there's a need for a specific language in describing the standards so there's accuracy. But at the same time, I would question if the standards are open for public comment, but if the public can't read the standards, I'm not sure that public comment is really meaningful, because the only people who can read them is other educators. And I believe that some educators, even that we have right now, would struggle with reading, much less implementing them. But my question is, And what I see here, we all cherish that 7%. We want it to go to 20%. But even if it's 20%, my question is, how do we speak to the needs of the other 80%? Are they going to be marginalized? Are we going to say, well, you know, what you're doing isn't as important, so we're going to focus on that 20%. Let's say we have 20%. And so as these standards are written, and I'm not trying to be confrontational here, but I really stretches my imagination to understand how, let's say the 80% heading to careers, how they would use imaginary numbers, how they would, the purpose of rational exponents, polynomial identities, and exponential models using logarithms, or I'll read this one again. Explain how the unit circle in the coordinate plane enables the extension of trigonometric functions to all real numbers interpreted as radian measures of angles transverse counterclockwise around the unit circle. No, I need somebody to help me on that one. But even if I could understand it, I really don't believe that it's a truck driver, a fisherman, or somebody in the mining industry. I struggle to understand how this could help them be successful in that career path. And so I believe the fundamental question we all have to ask is, are we going to create a set of standards? Are we going to create a set of standards that's totally focused on sending students to college? And let's say we have 20%. And are we going to marginalize the 80? Or are we going to, again, have standards that address total rigor, but for all students, and at the same time have that career path? And then everybody asks the question, and they say, well, what about the one in the career path that changes his mind and wants to go over to the college? Because that is the ultimate, at least we believe it's the ultimate. And I believe Representative Seaton can maybe speak to that better than I can, but in Northern Ireland, they ended up with two tracks. And the amazing conclusion was, with the two tracks, they actually ended up with more college graduates, because the students that were on the career track were so engaged in what they were doing, and they saw the meaning, purpose and meaning of it, that they actually were so engaged that they actually wanted to cross over, and they were better prepared to cross over, because if it was only a college track, they would have disengaged, and they perhaps wouldn't have even been close to qualified. So, comments, sir?
In regards to the 7%, I would say that the converse of that is that we are sending 93% of our students into the career track. I don't think they're collateral damage. I think that they're into careers, unless that 93% is unemployed. And we don't see that reflected. You know, we've got a 9% unemployment rate in Alaska. So, you know, I think that there's a difference between, you know, saying they're marginalized. Well, they have actually moved into careers. They've moved into the mining. They've moved into the logging. They've moved into the fishing, apparently, because they're not collecting unemployment. So I think we've done a better job with our standards and our focus in education, preparing our kids for careers, than we have for college completion, 4-year or 2-year degrees. So that might be an area that 7% is not enough. That's not enough, 7% getting into the engineers or the doctors or the architects or the biologists or the educators. You know, we're not getting, 7% is not enough to fill those positions.
Then could I ask the question? If we're sending if the purpose of education is to send our students out into the real world, and if that's the purpose of our education, could we then say that everything we teach should have a real life application? Wouldn't those thoughts flow together? And so then my question would be, and I'm not trying to be confrontational, my question is, I'm looking at these standards and I'm saying, how could I as a math teacher come up with a real life example to prove to my students that this is worthwhile, it's worth your while to study this? And I've done videos on, I've written math curriculum. I had a contract with Cook Inlet Tribal Council for 1 year, where I had to write curriculum to try to motivate Native students in Anchorage to get involved in the engineering program and the ANSET, in the ANSET program with the university. I wrote three. I actually did four videos. The last one was on matrices and simultaneous equations. That one hasn't seen a broad viewing yet. But anyway, I've written curriculum on this, and I've focused my whole life on trying to show students how math and science are important and how they're relevant. And so back to the point, I struggle because I, as a teacher, I don't know how to tell a student that for exponential models expresses a logarithm, the solution of AB to the CT power equals D, where A, C, and D are numbers in the base, B is 2, 10, or E, evaluate the logarithm using technology. I'd struggle to show a student how they could apply that to real life. I could see a student going to college, but somebody in the fishing industry, the mining industry, how, I think that's the gap. That's what I'm having a hard time to wrap my head around.
Thank you. I've commercial fish for 18 years, and I didn't need most of the stuff I learned in high school to commercial fish. And a good portion of the mining positions don't require high school education either. But I do know that when I fished, I decided that I was going to do more than fish, and I was going to take my product, and I was going to do value added, and I was going to bring it in, and I was going to smoke it, and I was going to, that required a college education, or a high school education at least. So we take the very highest skills in math in high school, and we say, okay, so where's the applicability? You know, and we could drop it down, and we could say, let's just drop it way down. Let's say, okay, the perimeter of a rectangle. I mean, when was the last time we used the perimeter of a rectangle? I mean, it's been a long time since I've used that. Or the circumference of a circle. I don't think that means we need to stop teaching the perimeter stop teaching geometry, even though a fisherman doesn't need it and a miner doesn't need it for the most part. But I think we're more than a set of skills. I think we're a sum of all we know. And I think there are things that that we know that we don't use on a daily basis, that we know that becomes really who we are, that gives us our sense of wonder when we know more than what's there. I mean, we wouldn't need to teach about the sun or the moon, really. As long as we had a tide book, the moon, could be irrelevant, as well as giraffes and manatees and vocabulary like winsome or plethora or onomatopoeia. I think those are skills that we don't use on a regular basis. I think it's important to know those things. I think it's important to have a basic understanding of geometry and how the world works, even though it may not fit into my career as a small business owner. So, I think the set of rigor we need to have needs to allow our kids to be able to compete head-to-head, no matter what they choose to do. And I consider, specifically when we're starting to compare urban and rural, I consider those ANSET students, Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, that we see on TV all the time, and coming from rural Alaska, all over rural Alaska, and they're saying, I'm taking calculus, I'm going to be a biologist, I'm going to be an engineer. I think we need to allow them that. I think we owe that to them to choose that path, more than putting a ceiling on with a different set of standards that may challenge them to become value-added fishermen. I think they need to be also had the opportunity to do more.
Yeah, Commissioner, but that's why we're just suggesting it. Nobody's mandating anything. We're suggesting a fast track for those ANSEP students. Nobody's saying that we should put a ceiling on anything. But we talk about this, and that was part of my issue with the standards, because as I went through the list, and I went through all 240 people, I found three people on that list that were not educators. There was two people from Take Flight Alaska, and there was the Jim Mariner, was the Board of Education member who was in a career path. So if there were people involved with careers, I was not able to identify them. I was going to call them. So I agree that there are other things that were onomatopoeia. I don't use it every day. I'm glad that I know what onomatopoeia is. At the same time, I believe that the standards, we desperately need educators involved in the process of developing standards. But I do believe that those from the career paths where our students are heading, there needs to be an equal voice, because that's where the students are heading. And we hear right now that the career destinations, they're saying the students aren't ready for us. And here's what I would suggest. Is that I believe, say there's a math problem and the employer says, the student doesn't know how to do the problem. I bet if you took that kid student back and put them in the textbook, they could solve the problem out of the textbook. But it's the real life application. We're not showing students, we're teaching them over here all these facts, and we've almost never show them the real life application. I believe that's where our system is failing. But I would also say that if we've got to show them the real life application, but if there is no real life application, perhaps we should stop doing it, because there's no shortage of information out there that we desperately need to know. The amount of information is increasing exponentially, and so I don't think we need to teach things that I learned back in 1950 whatever just because it was what I learned. There's some things that are desperately needed today that I'm not even aware of. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going to the museum. Go down to the museum, and you look at and Smithsonian. All of these places have the first Alaskan. All of the displays of all of the way they hunted, and with the IT used in getting those animals. And some of that equipment, a lot of the equipment for the far north, for even around here, is better than what was going on for thousands of the years that they were using it. It's math. It is science and math. Is ever there an effort to try to, in our school systems, look at that and get that part? That part is the part that really, in places like coastal communities, rural Alaska, that we really ought to be bringing that straight into the classroom. Testing, and I don't know how they tested was whether they lived or died, I mean, that's probably the best way to test anything. Do you survive or not?
That's a high-stakes test.
But that's, yeah, it is. But nonetheless, it's what happened here for thousands of years. And those kids are failing. And it's not their brains that are failing. It's our system. We're not helping people, and the chair keeps on talking about this. We're not really helping people understand that they might tend to start looking down at their elders, and that system of education went on for thousands of years. Elders to the children, and teaching them something that they kept in place for all of those years. That's the best education you could possibly get. And how do we build onto that and bring that in? I think it needs to be done.
Excuse me, Representative Pruitt and I do need to skedaddle. And Commissioner, thank you for your time. And here's my promise to you, sir. And I promise you I will fiercely defend, and you know I'm fierce, I will fiercely defend any standard for which you can show me a real, knew you or anybody can show me, a real-life application that I could turn around and tell my kids and my students, you need this in order to be successful. But, okay, so that's my promise to you. We do need to get back here on Wednesday morning, and we will address HB 330, but Representative Pruitt and I do need to head upstairs. So we'll take a brief at ease.
Thank you, and we will be back for Wednesday looking, and you'll have the mathematical standards. And I guess, would you compare those also, as a question I had, with the Alaska Anchor standards for reading in grades K through 5? It seems to be a little bit different structure, but I would like to get a comparison of the Anchor standards, the individual grade level, I guess I can't call them grade level expectations anymore, the grade level standards for each of those anchor standards, and then compare that with how that corresponds to the standards for mathematical practice and the, what are you calling those, not grade level expectations, the standards for each grade, or?
Just the performance standards.
Performance standards in math. Before we've got about 3 minutes more before we get Dr. Eckert, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the standards and compared to the core standards, is that what they're
Common Core?
Common Core is what's happening in the lower 48. Looking at the Common Core standards and then what the state or the group came up with, they're almost identical almost identical all the way. There's not much difference really between the core standards. Once in a great while there's something, but really it's pretty much the core standards except with a little deviation here and there. And I realize can you just tell me very quickly and the reason that they kind of adopted those is because of the fact, and I need to hear in your words where the state is going. If we can adopt these standards, what's it mean, and can we get out of No Child Left Behind? I mean, I'd like to hear the reason for all this.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Wilson. And that is one of the things that Representative Dick mentioned on his paper was the connection to No Child Left Behind. And there really is no direct connection to No Child Left Behind. What basically happened was National Governors Association, through the Chief Council of State School Officers, that's the commissioner's organization, they developed a set of standards called the Common Core. 45 states decided to buy in. To buy in, you had to buy in, you know, they were set in stone. You couldn't change them. We chose to make a few adjustments, and so we couldn't be officially a Common Core state. We made some changes. In regards to No Child Left Behind, It is simply a matter of one of the criteria is to have college and career-ready standards. The Common Core is recognized as a set of college and career-ready standards. Alaska standards, I believe, the new proposed standards are also. I've had these run by people who implemented the Common Core, and they've done an analysis for me. These would also be considered college and career-ready standards. So that would allow us to request a waiver if we chose to do so. So that's the only real connection between No Child Left Behind and this set of standards, is that it would give us the opportunity to request a waiver.
And follow up, Representative Wilson.
So for what I understand, the standards that we have now are not acceptable as far as No Child Left Behind goes. And so we can't opt out because they say what you have isn't good enough.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, I spoke to the Assistant Secretary of Education for the Department, the U.S. Department of Education, and I asked them that question, and I said, if we have not adopted our standards yet, but they are to our state board and potentially will be adopted in June, can we request a waiver at this time? And he suggested that, well, you can freeze your annual measurable objectives. You can freeze the bar. You know, that bar keeps going up higher and higher. You can freeze that while you're getting that done. And then but basically he said, yes, that the standards that you have in place now are not enough to request a waiver.
So,
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. So essentially, if we reject these standards and say we're not going to accept them because we don't feel it's going to fit what our kids need, then we would not be able to opt out of No Child Left Behind. We might be able to freeze it while we work on some more standards, but we will not be able to opt out.
That's correct. And the freezing would be with the understanding that we would apply for the waiver in September. That's the next deadline. So if HB 330 takes place, that will preclude us from opting out.
So
Representative Wilson.
So we'll just go on like we are now.
Correct. We'll have higher levels of schools deemed as failing by No Child Left Behind standards, and some other things will have to take place, but yes.
Okay. So I just...
And Representative Wilson.
I just wanted to make sure that I understood what the ramifications were and what would happen, and those things would happen anyway, whether we opt out or not. We would still go on like we're going now, except that maybe... with these standards, we wouldn't have to do certain testing. I mean, just tell me, if we did adopt the standards and then we opted out, what would that mean? What would happen?
Basically, through the chair, basically the only thing that changes is that AYP, the annual measurable progress that NCLB uses now, is a bar, and everybody has to get over the bar. 2014, everybody has to be above that bar. What it would allow us to do is change three things. One, our standards, we'd have to put our own standards in place. Two, we could change what the growth model. Our schools would still have to be accountable, but we could change that. So we could recognize we actually have something in place now. We could change that and use a growth model. So if students were way down here, far below proficient, but they were moving them in the right direction, they could be recognized for that. It would not be deemed failing. Because they're moving their kids in the right direction, even though they haven't got to this bar yet. That would be the biggest thing that would allow us to change and not be calling all of our schools failures. We would still need to have standards in place. We would still need to have assessments in place. The amount of accountability doesn't change, but we would get to determine that accountability. We would get to decide what that accountability would look like.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Wilson, I'd like to hold up here. We've got other items on the agenda, but what I would like to do is request that you lay that out in writing for us, because that's something that we all want to understand, and verbally going back and forth, sometimes we hear things that weren't meant or those kind of things. So I'd like to see that in writing as to what that is for the next meeting, as well as if you would provide us some examples of differences between the Alaska standards and the Common Core standards, so that we could have that. Are there any other things that the committee members would like the commissioner to have for us when he comes back on Wednesday? And I don't want to get a discussion going, but if there are questions that you want in writing, and the commissioner will be prepared to talk about the math standards and the English standards and the and those things as well. Representative Wilson, continuation, and then Representative Sisna.
Okay, just another thing. When you write that up, is there another chance after September to opt out? And if we can't opt out in September, when's the next chance?
There will be rolling deadlines. I don't know when the next one will be.
We're not looking for responses now. Okay. We're putting I'm the sorry, questions sorry. On the table. Representative Sisna.
Thank you. And I'm fairly sure that there has been, across the United States, a fair amount of research on the effectiveness of No Child Left Behind and where the problems have been and what the success is and the failures of that program. And coming from the self-esteem world, I really think using failures with school is really a bad thing, but I'd like to see research on that and see if, in fact, we are heading in a survivable direction.
Okay, thank you, Representative Sisna. Are there further questions? I see no other questions put on the table. If anyone does, I'm sure that we can get those to the chairman, Alan Dick's office, Representative Dick's office, and he'll forward those specific questions to you, and we look forward to continuing the conversation on Wednesday. And now we're going to go to a presentation from the Northwest Arctic Borough Superintendent Norm Eck. Dr. Eck, are you online?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. And just so you're aware, we do have your PowerPoint here, and we'll run that for you. And unless we have any complications, just we'll be following your presentation, and Annette will be going forward with the slides. So if you would go ahead with your presentation, appreciate it.
Thank you. It's good morning. For the record, I'm Norman Eck, Superintendent of Northwest Arctic Borough School District. I'm so pleased to be able to join you once again, and I'm sorry I'm not there in person. It's not a PowerPoint. It's actually a 9-minute video that we made for this presentation that we produced in-house, and I hope it's good enough that you'll enjoy it. But what it is it explains the cooperative arrangement that we have as a K-12 school district with post-secondary, our partnering up with the Alaska Technical Center here in Kotzebue, and the Chukchi campus, rural campus, out of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And from that, you've heard me speak about this before, is the magnet school Star of the Northwest that we're developing. And what's unique about it, it's designed for grades 11 through 14 to take students from the high school experience and into post-secondary in terms of three areas: process technology, healthcare, and public school teaching. So we did this video, and if it's there, if you can put it in and play it, I'd be very grateful, unless anyone has any questions for me.
We're starting the video right now.
Thank you so much.
And it's on the screen.
For the school district, Chukchi College and the Alaska Technical Center are working to provide the best opportunities possible for their students. A unique collaboration between the three institutions leads the way in student advancement in secondary and post-secondary education. The magnet school will be the future result of the finalization of this relationship.
Star of the Northwest Magnet School represents the highest effort of collaboration with our post-secondary partners, and it's going to lay down a career pathway now available to our regional students here at Northwest Arctic Borough School District, and soon our vision is to extend that opportunity statewide. A lot of success has come our way already, and we've demonstrated clearly that as the Northwest Arctic Borough School District continues to expand options with our friends at the Alaska Technical Center and over at our Chukchi campus, which is rural campus for UAF, we're seeing that the opportunities for dual enrollment, the opportunities to receive training regionally, are certainly in keeping with the needs and the goals of many of our rural youth.
I've been here for 2 years, and the 2 years that I've been here, I know that we have some people that have graduated with UAA nursing degrees that are now currently working at the Manilok, our health organization. We also have students that are that have become certified in construction trades, students that have become certified in the health CPA, and also different village health, I'm not sure what they call those. Anyway, we've got lots of students that are working in our region because of the training that they've received via the tech center in partnership with Chukchi. And also we have the high school tech prep program, in which we are in partnership with the school district in preparation for the magnet school.
This Chukchi Honors Program that we've been running here for more than two decades, it really gives students an opportunity to develop their writing skills in a way that I think if they didn't take the classes, their preparation for college might not be adequate, and then they might, when they went off to college, they might have to take a lot of remedial classes before entering into the, you know, the sort of core classes. And so by working with their writing skills at this level, it's almost a way for them to develop these skills now and simulate the college experience, so that, you know, when they go off to colleges elsewhere, their skills are in place.
Not only do I teach high school mathematics, but I teach culinary arts, which is a new program here at the high school, and it's associated with the tech center that we have down the road. This is the second year that I started this class, and I know of for sure four students that are applying for college and they want to go into culinary arts. We are trying to get this course to be a full-time college course, and we are working with ATC and Chukchi to establish that.
Well, the star of the Northwest Magnet School is a true partnership with the Northwest Arctic Borough School District, the Kotzebue High School, UAF, Chukchi Campus, and the Alaska Technical Center. Not only do we work very closely together, we also align ourselves with business and industry partners to meet industry standards. Students will earn their high school diploma, they'll earn industry recognized certifications and college credit while preparing for careers in healthcare, in process technology, and teaching. We have joined forces to provide opportunities for Alaskans to obtain employment in current jobs with immediate openings. These are high demand and high paying positions that are available almost anywhere in the state.
The courses I teach are nursing assistant training, medical terminology, introduction to health careers, emergency trauma training, and a course called Professional Skills in the Workplace. And I think the collaboration between the Alaska Technical Center, the high school, and Chukchi Campus, UAF, is really important for students. What I see and what I've seen in the last few years is that students that are in high school that are taking some of these courses really have an eye-opening awareness of opportunities that are available to them once they get out of high school. These courses open doors for students, I've seen students who really begin to have an awareness of their capabilities.
Someday I hope to become a naturopathic doctor. That's my story.
I hope to get a full-time job, preferably at Red Dog, as a millwright apprentice, and hope to become a millwright journeyman someday.
I'm doing this because I don't think I could sit in an office all day, and I would prefer to work hands-on.
I'm currently enrolled in a
industrial mine technology course for millwright maintenance. So I'm here.
I previously went to Alaska Technical Center in 2003 without completing, and I went back in 2011 after having a family, knowing that I can't support my family without having an education. So I went back to school to provide for my family for the rest of their life.
So this year is the first year our school has worked together with UAF to bring college credit for our Algebra 1 students. And there have been several advantages to this. So far I've seen better attendance with our students, and there's also been some healthy competition since Cayena High School is also doing the pilot program with us. All of our kids are very connected to each other, and so when they see other students from this region on the same class, then they kind of step up their behavior and their production and what they're submitting to the teacher so that they look good with the other students in the region. Another advantage is a student that is planning on going to college and does not like math voiced his opinion to me, and I told him, well, hey, you get through these college credits and then there's less math you need to do while you're in college. And he has really stepped up, come in for extra help, and worked a lot harder on his math with the idea of thinking, I'm knocking out some of my college credits now while I'm in high school, so it'll be easier while I'm in college.
My students are from the introductory to teaching college class, and these students are interested in education, but they're getting dual credit in high school as they also take a college level class. The kids are familiar with the high school itself, so as they take this college level class, they're in a comfort zone, which keeps their interest and helps the kids keep their self-esteem as they take a higher level class.
And I plan on going to Arizona State University in the fall. And I plan on studying political science.
I want to go to college, and I want to try to be a vet.
Across the state, we recognize that the Department of Labor has posted many, many types of calls for skilled and qualified workers. And Startland Northwest Magnet School will meet that challenge with sister institutions around the state as one of several rural training centers dedicated to making sure that we have trained Alaskans for the Alaskan workforce.
Thank you. I think you probably heard the video is completed. Yes. Superintendent, would you like to go ahead and add some information?
Well, thank you. I did have. Did you get my cover letter and then a booklet on the Magnet School on the Star of the Northwest?
Yes,
you
we did.
You have that.
Yes,
okay,
we.
Okay, very good. And I have talked with the committee several times in the past, you know, about this program as we've been developing it and piloting it. And we're beginning the construction on the Alaska Technical Center to completely remodel it and expand it to be able to be the Star of the Northwest, and to have high school students intermixed with the post-secondary students there. And so it's very exciting to us to be able to pull this together. We are hoping through the capital budget to get money to begin building the dorm for the high school students. We have a dorm at the tech center for, for adult students, but we need to have dorm space, and we're hoping for 100 beds for secondary students. So I'm just really honored to be asked to make the presentation, and I hope the video was clear in terms of what we're working toward doing. And thank you so much for this opportunity.
Well, we appreciate that. And Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, when you're building this, are you for 100 students? Is this so that you can, is it set up so that other students from other parts of your area can come and go to school there, or is it just for your immediate area?
No, that's why the dorm is so important, is the idea is to be able to have some Concert View students, but we're looking at the high flyers, the ones who really want to accomplish something good with their career, ones who are academically successful, to be able to challenge. So many of our dropouts are those who are bored with school, and we can challenge them. These students are smart, and so this would be a place where they can come. And you know, the time for regional boarding schools is here in the state. We need several regional boarding schools around the state to meet the needs of the rural high school students that do not get for them an adequate education, and where there's only one or two high school teachers in those small schools.
Follow up, Representative Wilson, and then Representative Sisna.
How much extra slots are there once you have students there from your immediate region? How many other slots are going to be available?
Well, I wouldn't expect to pull. We have 10 high schools outside of Concert View, and there's anywhere from 10 students in those high schools to 65. And I wouldn't expect to pull more than a few students out of them. So I would suggest that there's probably 40-50 slots that could be filled from around the state for anyone who's interested in working towards becoming a teacher or in healthcare up to a registered nurse, or the careers in process technology, you know, which is the resource fields of mining and petroleum production.
Great. Thank you very much.
And before I go to Representative Sisna, I just wanted to follow up. So you have some high schools there that are 10 students. You have three or so would come to this regional boarding facility. How's that going to impact the school as far as small school funding and keeping those schools open?
Well, thank you for that question, sir. You know, there's probably 45 kids at the school. It just happens to be there's only 10 of those. They're K-12 schools. Outside of Concert View, all of our schools are K-12.
So you're not anticipating this being a magnet for kids from small schools across the region and impacting closure of schools?
Yeah, I'm not expecting that it would, because all of our small high schools tend to be, as a matter of fact, I think they all are K-12 schools. So I wouldn't see it impacting that in any way.
Okay.
And I think it's important that we keep those small schools open as an option for our, for our students and for our families, where that is what they want. They want that education, and they want to live in the village. This provides for students to be able to develop a career in a high-paying field, but also live in the village. They could become those teachers. They can become those nurses or nurses' aides. They can become, the higher-level people working at Red Dog Mine or at the other mines in the state or on the North Slope.
Sure, and we really appreciate that. And Representative Sisna had a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Dr. Eck, the question that I was going to start with was that 11 to 14, which grade 11 through 14, which makes it feel like it's the later parts of high school and the junior college is what it sort of looks like. But it looks also like there might be many other options that you might have there, and you've probably thought about them. Since you are aiming at the communities around Kotzebue and up the various rivers in that area, and they probably do desperately need to have the magnet school focuses that you have. But have you thought about short-term intense camps or just classes that I think the university has a number. I actually have taken a couple where it's every day except maybe the weekends or maybe Sunday, and then longer days and getting kids in. Doing things like that that could actually involve more kids from more schools around your area and getting them ready for whatever future endeavor they go to. Have you thought about that? And then I have a follow-up question, please. Yeah.
Yes, I through the chair, Representative Sisna, thank you. Yes, we have. And we will be planning to do that as well as we get the construction done. This next year will be our construction year, and we're looking forward to doing those things. Something that's a real need in our region, but as I talk to people from rural Alaska across the state, is driver's license. And so one thing we've done is we've purchased a driver's ed car, and so that's something we'll really try to do is bring in students from bring in all the students in our district, for instance, who are 16 and older, and run them through driver's ed, for instance. But yes, we will be looking at those high impact camps or training situations that can make a big difference for students' lives. But we will be looking at those things. But thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you, Representative Sisna. Follow up.
And thank you very much. And my question, my last question is also, I looked through everything here. It's maybe too early for you, but your model looks like a really great one. We have other communities that are doing similar things, but not bringing in the. There's one, actually, junior college that I know of, and that's in Glen Allen. And I hope we hear from them at some point. But your model is a great one. So, of course, I'm wanting to see a web page. And I looked through everything, and I didn't see a web page. Are you planning on getting one, or how could we get more information? Thank you.
Oh, thank you, and through the chair, Representative Sisna, thank you so much. Yeah, we need to. We have been working over the last couple months to rebuild our district's website, and so that will be something that we will be putting up. Thank you. And so it's a point well taken. I can't get that information out too soon. So thank you. We'll put these things on the website here, hopefully within the next week or two at least, so we have these items up there, and then put the other points of discussion in terms of what we can be doing right now. So thanks so much for your thoughts.
Thank you very much. Are there further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Superintendent, for your presentation, and we're hoping for the best of results from the program. So thank you again for calling in. We'll now go to We'll now go to House Bill 272. And just for committee members' information, there was a potential amendment that was distributed. That's not going to be offered. So that amendment's withdrawn, so we're not considering it. Welcome, Representative Guerra. Would you fill us in where we are on House Bill 272 and the questions that were posed from the last time we heard this bill? Our intention is to have a second hearing on this bill and put it aside until the chairman returns. We do have Diane Behrens with us if people have questions for the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As folks remember...
And for the record?
Representative Les Guerra, District 23, and thank you to Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee. As you recall, the bill provides a lower... provides a principal reduction for students who stay in-state or come back to state after completing their degree. You can hold on for a minute. Toby, could we send in a cover letter explaining what the answers to the questions? I know it's been a while.
We'll take just a brief at ease. Looking at the materials to make sure that the entire committee had the materials, and we have two sets of materials. One is the March 14th letter from Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education to the chairman about default rates, etc. And there is also the email from Toby Smith dated March 6th and the accompanying Alaska statutes. And so those are the materials that we have before us. Representative Garrett, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilson had asked, there are a number of statutes that are referenced in the bill, and those are technical in nature, but the statutes referenced in the bill have to do with the rules for default, the rules for consolidating loans, and the rules for eligibility, which we don't change in our bill, but they had to be referenced in the bill.
And Representative Wilson, that was in response to your question. Are you satisfied with the response?
Yes, and they did a very thorough job. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Garrett, go ahead.
I think we went through the mechanics of the bill the last hearing, but
Would you go over that again, just
sure.
Review it in the second hearing?
Sure. The original intention was to reduce the interest rates for students who stayed in Alaska or returned to Alaska. To reduce the cost, we don't give the discount until somebody completes their degree. The commission has the authority to determine what a timely completion of a degree is. So we leave that to them.
And is that degree or certificate?
Yes, or certificate, okay. Sure. So it's voc ed and traditional higher education. They believe it's much easier to administer if we reduce the principal rather than reducing the interest rate. They said it'll save them on staffing. So we reduce the principal amount, not the interest rate, in response to the request by the commission. And so as the bill reads right now, you get a 3% reduction in your principal annually if you return to Alaska or stay in Alaska after completing your degree. We have residency requirements that reflect those that we use in the permanent fund dividend qualification, which basically says if you leave Alaska, you have to be an Alaska resident for at least a year before leaving Alaska to get the reduction when you come back. And if you stay in Alaska, you have to allow somebody to become a resident after a year. You can't avoid that constitutional requirement, but they don't become a resident until they've been here for at least a year and then declare Alaska residency. So they can't vote in another state or get tax deductions in another state and then pretend they have Alaska residency. But beyond that, the Constitution doesn't allow you to limit Alaska residency more than that. So we use the most stringent residency requirements we can under the Constitution. But right now, roughly 40% of students who leave Alaska don't come back. Right now, the student loan rates are somewhere between 6.2% and 7% for new loans and higher for older loans, when at the same time you can get a used car loan for about 2.5% or 3%. There are reasons for that. The commission is not doing anything wrong, but if we want to sort of stop the brain drain and make college more affordable for students, one way is to do forgiveness, but that's very expensive. We used to have an old forgiveness program, probably too expensive, so we're doing this through a loan reduction mechanism as a way to try and accomplish the same goals, but at a price that we can afford.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for the sponsor? We do have Diane Behrens in the office. We'll ask her to come up when we're to address her memo as well as other issues. Seeing no questions, thank you very much. Diane, would you come up? And just for everyone's information, we did have public testimony previously on the bill. We did close that. However, if there's anyone that wishes to testify on the bill, we will reopen public testimony. Welcome, Diane. Would you identify yourself for the record and then proceed? Two things that we'd like to do. First of all, maybe look at your March 14th amendment. Any general statements you want to make on the bill are also welcome as well. And then we would like a discussion on pending fiscal note implications, since we've adopted a different version than the original version.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. And your initial question had to do with the March 14th memo. Members had several questions, information they wanted provided regarding default rates, expectation on the effect of a principal reduction program on the default rate, timely completion of degree, what is the experience in Alaska for timely completion of degree, and the responses are contained in my memo. I don't have any additional information to share, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Diane, I was just kind of hadn't realized that the out-of-state default rates were much lower than the in-state default rates.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that is true, and it's historically been the case. We have not done a study of the reasons for that, but if you look at the if you look at the types of schools that the students are attending out of state, they tend to be more highly selective. As a result, we can presume that those students were more prepared for college, are succeeding at higher rates, and therefore have the wherewithal to earn wages that allow them to repay the loans as they're due.
So, Diane, looking at that first page, I think that that's where Representative Wilson was talking about. It's just been consistent over time that we are that in-state default rates are 1-2% higher than the default rate for out-of-state schools. Is that a default rate for out-of-state schools? Is that somewhat comparable to other states and other loan programs, or have you looked at that?
Mr. Chair, we haven't really looked at it. It's very difficult because if you're comparing state alternative loan programs, often the terms and conditions of those programs are quite different. If you were to look at the alternative program, for instance, in New Jersey, they have a very high underwriting standard for students to qualify. They must have a creditworthy cosigner on those loans, and so you would see loan default rates that are substantially lower than these. The practice in Alaska has been to have, at least until the last 2 or 3 years, a loan that is available basically to anyone, regardless of their credit history or lack thereof. So it's only in recent years that we would expect to see sort of comparable rates to other state programs.
And I guess what concerns me as we went to that, having to have a creditworthy cosigner in 2010 or 8-9, I think it was, and the 2010 rate on that first page is significantly higher than the previous rates. Do you see any connection between those two things? I mean, we thought that those would be the opposite.
Mr. Chair, those are loans that went into repayment and were in repayment for at least a year in 2010. So we do expect to see, as those loans that we made in 2009 and 2010, as those students complete their education and begin repayment, we expect to see substantial improvements in these rates.
Okay, so those rates included all of the previous loans that were being paid back. So that wouldn't probably include any of the loans that were made with the What was that?
Creditworthy cosigner.
Creditworthy cosigner.
It's highly unlikely that any of those loans would have been included in that cohort. The other thing I would just point out is that typically over time, the state of the economy certainly has an impact on default rates, and we've actually seen in the federal loan program rates rise pretty substantially. It's not huge jumps, but they're meaningful increases over the last 3 years.
And I imagine since what we're hearing on the national news is that student loan debt now exceeds debts on credit card debt, that we'll probably be anticipating some ramifications with that trillions of dollars being less connected to, or just becoming a greater proportion of overall debt in the country.
That's true.
On the second page, there was a Alaska student loans had a very much higher than supplemental education, family loans, those kind of things. Do you have an explanation of why in 2010 there was such a jump in Alaska student loans default rates?
I do. Mr. Chair, the Alaska student loans it's actually the predecessor program to the Alaska Advantage loans, which we initiated in 2002. So these are really quite aged loans. We had in 2008-2009, we instituted some alternative repayment options that provided borrowers with relief. When we looked at the outcome of borrowers who were taking those options and looked at whether or not after having had that period of relief were they able to become a performing loan, we found that it was just postponing the kind of delinquency and default that eventually occurred when we ran out of these various options to defer, forbear, reduce payments. And so we trimmed down the options that they had, because what was happening is their interest costs were climbing when those costs were added back to their debt after these periods of relief. They still weren't able to address their delinquency. So we've just eliminated some of those options.
Okay, and I guess the alternative loan consolidation is just zero or extremely low as far as the default rate from 2007 through 10. Can you give us a handle on what you...
Certainly. Mr. Chair, in 2004, we actually instituted for the first time an alternative consolidation loan. At that time, we were offering a discounted rate. One of the things we wanted to do, because the borrowers had loans over a period of years and the terms of those loans were all different, there was an advantage to us to offer a lower rate to get all of those loans consolidated under a single note. It was simplicity. We eliminated in that new promissory note a lot of the forbearances and deferments that existed in the underlying original notes, and so we wanted to incent borrowers to consolidate. So we offered a lower rate, but in exchange for that, we also had a requirement that the borrowers have a meet a minimum FICO score, or if they failed to meet the minimum FICO score, that they had made full and timely payments for 2 years on those underlying loans before they were allowed to consolidate. So the quality of those loans were some of the best of the old Alaska student loan program, and as a result, you can see that they default at a very low rate.
And can you give us kind of an idea of how much of that alternative loan consolidation is taking place? Is that an attractive program? Is it 2% of your population? Is it 20%?
I know in the first year that we offered it, we had $40 million in loan volume for it. It continued at that pace for probably 2 or 3 years. So I would expect now that we have close to $100 million in consolidated loans. But that there was sort of an unmet demand for that really saw high activity in the early years. It's a very low amount of activity right now. One of the reasons for that is that the consolidation rate is a 7.5 interest rate right now, and many students who borrowed in the 2000s, early 2000s, have rates that are lower than that. So they're not motivated to consolidate their loans.
Okay, thank you. And in the black and white copy here, I just want to make sure, on the chart that's on the institutional claim, default rate, Alaska institution rate is at the top line there?
It is.
Okay. Just sometimes these black and white and gray lines, we just want to make sure there. And your analysis was that this program would probably not materially change the default rate on the loans?
Mr. Chair, that is my conclusion. The reasons people default are because they didn't complete their degree and they're unable to. There's two reasons. The majority of them default because they didn't complete a degree and are unable to really be gainfully employed. There are folks who overborrowed and who have very high rates of who had very high levels of debt, but they're the smaller proportion. Typically, what we see is those with larger debt loads actually have the ability to earn a wage and repay their loan. So we don't see a 3% principal reduction really impacting that materially.
So unless the idea of a 3% discount would stimulate people to stay in and complete their degree, in that case, they default at much lower rates, those that complete at lesser rates than the others. And so in that case, their additional earning capacity might have some effect.
That's true.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Are there further questions of Diane on her answers to the questions that were put forth? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess on the top of page 3, that paragraph, which is the tail end of paragraph number 2, among the last sentences, generally, regardless of the underlying reasons for the lack of capacity to pay as agreed, borrowers fail to be influenced or motivated by the consequences of delinquency. So what are the consequences of delinquency?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, the consequences of delinquency can actually be quite great. We, at the commission, we have the ability to garnish permanent fund dividends. We have the ability to administratively levy wages. We can put individuals' occupation or professional license in a suspended status. That's not something that the commission has really pursued because
it's tough to pay it back.
Exactly. So there are fairly serious consequences. We also credit report them. So each of their underlying loans that are delinquent are shown as delinquent on their credit report. That can have consequences for them as well.
Follow us, President Feige.
Thank you. So I guess what else can we do to, I guess it sounds like the consequences of delinquency are pretty severe, so do we need to reinstitute debtors' prisons or something like that?
Through the chair, Representative Feike, that would be a policy call that would be above my
answer. Okay, thank you.
And thank you. Are there any other questions on the March 14th memo answering the questions of the committee? Seeing none. Diane, we also had a question, actually it might pertain to the last, on the fiscal note and the mechanism in the bill for an appropriation to fund the principal reduction for the student loans. Would you address those issues?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, as you know, these the loans in question are actually the assets of the Alaska Student Loan Corporations. and in financing those loans in the bond market and through other forms of debt that the corporation is liable for, we commit to certain income streams off of those loans. And so anytime the legislature decides to create a program to relieve debt, such as the one proposed in this bill, there needs to be an associated compensation to the corporation to ensure the corporation is held harmless from that and is able to continue to make its debt payments as they come due. And so the fiscal note that we'll be preparing for the new CS will reflect both the cost of the principal reduction as well as a component for the interest that would be lost to the corporation, because a principal reduction will accelerate the rate at which the loans are paid down. In other words, the borrowers would end up paying off sooner than they otherwise would have.
And Diane, is if has the Student Loan Corporation been constrained by the amount of principal you have available to offer as loans, or has that been relatively unlimited?
Mr. Chair, actually, since 2008, we have been funding new loans with the assistance of the state. We actually entered into a relatively short-term loan from the state in order to continue to finance. So we use both recycled repayments to finance new loans as well as draw on the loan that we have from the state. And that's been the case through the current year. We do expect to be back in the bond market in 2013 to issue new debt for new alternative loans. But the loan volume really has dropped substantially in the last 2 years. We now make in alternative loans less than $15 million a year in loans. And there are several reasons for that, mostly changes to the federal program and the federal rules that no longer allow institutions in Alaska to package our loans for students.
So I guess my question is that, and we welcome the chair back, the availability of the state prepaying principal to the Student Loan Corporation would seem to allow that to be reissued as new debt. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out why, if the state is needing, you know, to give principal so it can be loaned, why that would be seen as a detriment on early payment of debt, if that debt amount is actually paying off to the Student Loan Corporation, so that you have that to reloan.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I should just be very clear that the CS that the sponsor has brought through the committee really addresses the concerns that were expressed relative to the initial couple of versions of the bill. This bill ensures that the corporation is held, that this version of the bill ensures that the corporation is held harmless. So I don't believe that those negative perceptions carry through to this current version.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you. That clarifies things. I thought I was hearing you say that the prepayment of principal through an appropriation by the state of these up to 3% of those loans was a significant negative, and I'm happy to hear that that's not considered in the current version.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Seaton, it is not. As long as the corporation is held harmless from that, and it's my understanding that that's the sponsor's intent, and the fiscal note would reflect that, then we don't have concerns about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other comments from committee? Just myself, I'm a little uncomfortable just stepping into the middle of this. Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chairman, we got these answers. We have a pending fiscal note, and I announced to the committee that it would wait until you returned at another meeting to consider moving the bill. But that's your choice now, since you're back here. But I just wanted to let you know what I had told the committee in your absence.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Yes, and I think wisdom says that there's many good components of the bill, but wisdom does say that Representative Pruitt and I do get up to speed on this, and so we will hear this at a future date. I don't think we won't move to get it out of committee today. And for the record, Representative Pruitt has just joined us again. Both of us coming back from. Looks like lots went on. So thank you, Diane Behrens, and thank you. I'd like to thank the sponsor of the bill, and we certainly will take this up at a future date. Okay. Okay, Wednesday, March 21, 8 a.m. in this room, we will hear from superintendent presentation of Cusbuck School District, then HB 330, State Education Standards. And if we have time, we'll deal with SB 8, student questionnaires and surveys, and HJR 39, urging the state to opt out of No Child Left Behind. I would encourage committee members to pay attention to, you will receive a new CS for HB 330, and I would really encourage you to pay attention to that between now and then, because we will need your input on polishing that CS. And with no further business, we're adjourned at Representative Seaton. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the members that had to leave, just for everybody's understanding, we did pose some questions to the commissioner, and he'll be ready to address those on Wednesday.
Thank you. Okay, committee adjourned.